Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
We build up our farms, gardens, and homes to satisfy our needs, but then they sneak in and steal away all our work. Their unrelenting assault on what we believe to be ours leads us to ask, can we control pests without harming ourselves and our world? Hello out there, you are tuned into the 1,151st edition of the Food Chain Radio Show, right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Manila who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Folks, we build up our farms and our gardens and our homes to provide for our needs, for food or flowers and you name it. But they have needs too, and so they sneak right in and steal everything we thought was ours. They are the aphids that suck the life out of crops, the deer that jump the fence and eat the roses, the gophers that tunnel in and eat the roots right out from underneath that new peach tree, the raccoon that marches in the entire family into the dog door and messes up the kitchen, the rats that move in and foul up the place with their fleas and fecal matter, and of course the skunks that waddle through as if not to be denied by anything or anybody. And here's the rub. If we don't control them, they control us. One way to control pests is to poison them, a skill at which we have become very adept these days. Consider for just one example how we have genetically re-engineered plants like corn and soybeans to become lethal killers. We have inserted genes into those crops so that we may now drench entire fields with glyphosate herbicides, kill all the weeds, but leave the crops unscathed. And we have infused those crops with Bacillus thuringiensis, which is a bacterial pesticide that eats the stomachs right out from those insects that dare nibble on our crops. In fact, we have become so adept with our poisons that one farmer may now grow thousands of acres of crops with no insects and no weeds. A real, genuine miracle. But that miracle does have costs. The poisons we use just don't go away. They become part of our world and ourselves. The glyphosate we use to kill weeds is now in our blood and in our bones. The insecticide we use to kill mosquitoes also kills pelicans. And the poison we feed to rats, we also feed to owls. A different strategy to control pests is to outwit them. This strategy will require us to do some serious thinking. But as Sun Tzu said in his Art of War, if you know the enemy and know yourself, you need not fear the results of 100 battles. And so today we go in search of ways to win 100 pest control battles. And who better to help us outwit pests than our friend Thomas Whitman, who is the non-toxic humane pest control expert with Gophers Limited. Thomas, welcome back to the Food Chain.
Thank you, Michael. Great to be here.
Great to have you again. Fair warning, folks. Thomas and I are longtime friends, occasional fishermen together, and advocates, as it were, of local agriculture. Thomas has quite a background in a lot of different things. One of the most fascinating things is that your experience in the Peace Corps, right?
Right, in the Peace Corps.
I was a
three-time volunteer.
And one of the things that really fascinated, one of your stories that really fascinated me about you, is that the Peace Corps would fly you out into the middle of nowhere, where they had a truck or something that had broken down, and they'd land on a road or something, and then leave you there with a bag of tools, and you had to fix the truck in order to get back.
That's right. That was one of the more adventurous parts of my time teaching auto mechanics and developing countries, was rescuing forlorn vehicles in the middle of nowhere.
Wow. And you also been on the board of EcoFarm for a long, long time as well.
Right. EcoFarm is the Ecological Farming Association, and we produce the EcoFarm Conference every year, where we take over a Sylmar, the conference center in in Pacific Grove for 4 days a year.
And throw on a big celebration. People come from all over the world and learn about ecological agriculture. A lot of people are becoming aware of ecological-based agriculture, right? It seems to be.
Yeah, they're not just... in fact, it's becoming multidimensional. I mean, now there's not just organic, but there's lots of other new advancements in ways of thinking about the system as a whole.
Lots of new ways of thinking about what traditionally started off as organic agriculture. Our knowledge of it is expanding, and we're challenging with new frontiers all the time.
Yeah, now we're looking at not just organic, but we're looking at the social structure of agriculture, and we're looking at a part of agriculture that's being termed a regenerative.
Mm-hmm.
So it's
way beyond organic, right?
Well, I wouldn't say it's way beyond organic. I mean, organic is still the status quo. It's just looking at adding different aspects to it. It's a little confusing in some ways.
Well, it has to be. That way we can spend time thinking about it. If it's easy to understand, we'd understand it and let it go. But when somebody comes to you and says, we're thinking regenerative agriculture, you got to start thinking, what the heck does that mean? And,
well,
it means regenerate. Means you're regenerating the earth.
Correct. But you know, originally it was called sustainable agriculture and still is. And we kind of left that term sort of behind when chemical companies started using that same word.
It's like that, isn't it?
And so we had to kind of evolve a little bit. But, you know, the sustainable idea is something that I think the most prominent thing that struck me was a one-time professor and partner of mine, Stephen Gleisman, said to me that he had just returned from China, and he was standing in a field that had been grown continuously for 4,000 years.
Farmers of 40 centuries.
Yeah, that is sustainable.
Yep. And so when we think about that, you have to be thinking regenerative as well, because you can't grow something for 4,000 years without burning it up. So you continually have to be regenerating that soil.
Right.
Amazing stuff.
Ducks.
Now, another element that's very interesting about you is that you are one of the founding members of the Molino Creek Collective. Now, heard a lot about farm co-ops, but very little about a farm collective. The only collectives I know would have been those that were tried out in the Soviet Union and Communist China. And they didn't work out too well. But yours seem to have worked out very well. The Molino Creek Farm Collective. Growing dry farm tomatoes.
Right. Well, we were very lucky to have had some very inspirational leaders in the beginning. And some are still in the collective.
So when you say collective, that means you are equal owners in this farm endeavor, enterprise,
right.
And the land.
I actually am not a member anymore, but I was for 25 years. And we owned this beautiful piece of land in Davenport, 136 acres, together for all this time, since 1982. And as members, we never divided the land in any way.
So it was a single unit that you didn't divide it up into 14 different parcels. It was one unit. You worked together to farm it.
Right, and we still do.
Wow. Now, one of the things that you did while there was that you became an expert at managing the gopher population.
Yeah, my life path seems to have join the gophers in some ways. As a farmer there, I went out and caught gophers every morning, and it was something you just have to do. When you're growing something, you're growing populations that like what you're growing as well as anyone else, so gophers like it.
You know, that's something city people probably don't think about too much. They don't think about the notion that There's a farmer out there growing strawberries or corn or whatever, but there's all kinds of critters that want what that farmer's growing.
Well, that's exactly right. In fact, I give a lot of classes to the farm and garden apprentices, and the first thing they ask is, well, why can't we just share the bounty, you know?
And hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Often what's eating what are pests, and they're eating your crops, your plants, your everything. So how do you stop them? Got to stop them or they'll run away with what you're doing. We have Thomas Whitman with us, and we will be right back. Please do stay tuned.
And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, folks, seems like no matter what you grow, something else wants what you want to grow. And so if you're growing roses, well, there's deer that would love to eat them. How about apples? Deer love those too. Just no matter what you grow, there's something that wants it. It's you're putting together all of this wonderful energy, and there it is. It's free for the taking unless you stop them. So that's what we're talking about today, is how do you stop pests? How do you control them? And we're especially interested in how you can control them without poisons. So we have with us Thomas Whitman, who is the pro at Gophers Limited. And Thomas, you are a humane pest control expert. What do you mean by humane? Let's start there.
Oh, that's a very subjective question, Michael.
It's well, on your website.
I know. Well, we don't like harming animals, and I work with a lot of different animals. And gophers, which is probably our main focus, we have found a trap that actually is, well, humane is, again, a hard question, but it does kill the animal. But the animal dies in seconds using this trap that I use, and some other traps do take a lot longer for the animal to die. And then, of course, if you're using poisons, it may take the animal eating four or five times to die, and it often will come out and die on the surface because a lot of the poisons make the animal very thirsty.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people are concerned about that humane treatment of animals, too. Recalled a recent conversation in which I was listening to two gals talk, and one gal talked about using stuffing rose branches down a gopher hole and how that would cause the gopher to cut itself on the thorns and it would bleed out in the hole. The other gal said, oh, that's so cruel to cause a gopher to bleed out in a hole. I would much rather use a trap that kills it instantly.
Well, and, I agree.
And that's kind of what you're talking about, right?
Yeah. But there are other, you know, ways to handle the problem. You can put barriers in. Mm-hmm. It depends on the scale you're at. If you're a farmer, you're not going to be able to fence the gophers right out of your fields. But if you're a small scale,
somebody with a garden in the backyard,
garden could yeah easily.
So that's something too. If you were to tell a commercial farmer, like we were just talking with earlier today, has an orchard with thousands of gophers in it, and you were to talk to him about being humane, he would probably say, I just want to kill them. I just want to get rid of them. But so is there a difference in, you know, in commercial scale with respect to humanely treating pests?
Well, I mean,
If you have a thousand of them, are
I do a lot of consulting on large farms and vineyards and orchards, and it's not only humane to use a very effective trap, but it's also efficient. And so the trap that I use is very easy to set. It takes less than a minute to set it, open a gopher hole, set it, and move on. You can monitor the trap from the surface. It's humane, and I have helped farmers to... Well, my biggest success was a vineyard down in Santa Maria where they had a 30,000-acre vineyard, and they were using poisons, and they wanted to get off the poison treadmill. And so I taught their workers how to use these traps. It's called the cinch gopher trap. Mm-hmm. And kind of the secret is most large farms and orchards are made into blocks. And so you work from the center of the block to the outside, and then you just need to patrol the outside edges, which minimizes the labor.
Right. And thus you can manage that control. It's a lot. You talk a lot about knowing your enemy, too, knowing the life of a gopher, or knowing the life of any pest to be a good pest control expert, right?
Right. And gophers are very interesting in that they, when they build a tunnel, they push their soil to the outside, and then they close the tunnel up. And the technique that we use is called surface trapping, where you open the tunnel back up, and this trap has a long reach you put in the ground. When the gophers come back to close the tunnel, that's when they get caught. And then, so there's no bait involved. It's just taking advantage of the gopher's activities.
And the gopher simply must close the hole.
They always close their
burrow. Why must they close their hole?
Well, I think it's because they're protecting themselves from predation themselves.
Mm-hmm. From snakes and whatnot?
Yeah.
So knowing that the gopher must close the hole gives you a means of dealing with it, though.
Right, and that's the key to dealing with most pest problems is understanding their activities. You know, the other thing is that there are two other burrowing animals that are in our gardens and farms and fields, actually, and rats as well. I'm talking about moles and voles, as well as gophers. And
what's the difference between a mole and a vole?
Well, there's a V and an N.
Okay.
But the big difference is that a mole is actually a completely different species of animal in the shrew family, and a vole is actually a rodent that's actually a mouse, wow, known as a meadow mouse. And the other thing that's interesting is they all seem to use the same tunnels. Once a gopher may build a tunnel system, a mole may start using it, and then a vole may start using it.
So you have it's like an underground freeway system for critters.
Right. So one of the things that I do when I train people is I teach them to recognize the difference between when a vole, not a vole, when a mole is in the tunnel or when a gopher is in the tunnel. Because the big difference between gophers and moles is that gophers eat plants and plant roots, and moles are insectivores. They eat insects that can actually be a problem, like potato bugs and grubs.
So one's a friend and the other's a foe.
Correct.
So don't kill the friend, kill the foe.
Well, and moles are a lot harder to catch, so it's a waste of time to put your energy into it.
You know, got a break coming up here in a couple minutes, but I did want to backtrack a little bit and talk about how we seemed, you know, since Rachel Carson's, we seem to really be coming to grips with the fact that we have to tend to our environment as we're going about our business of taking care of ourselves on Earth here. And yet, you know, I look at the heartland of our country and see that what we have done in reengineering the crops in order to use ever more amounts of poisons, I don't know. Where's the consciousness in that?
Well, you know, it's interesting is you bring up Rachel Carson. I think we're about to see a second silent spring. I see people that are they're more and more aware and concerned about the amount of poisons that are not just being used on the animals that they're targeted, but those poisons are moving up the food chain to our apex predators like mountain lions and bobcats.
And us,
our bodies have them too. Our drinking water has them.
And the glyphosate we spray on the weeds is now in our blood. I think the University of San Francisco did a random sample of blood supply of blood from submitted from people from throughout the United States. 97%. Of those samples contained glyphosate.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's frightening.
So when you say non-toxic, you're, you know, really addressing a huge issue.
Yeah, it is a big issue, and there's this barrier called labor. It takes more labor to use traps and mechanical methods.
Well, let's pick that up when we get back, folks. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Thomas Whitman with us. He of Gophers Limited, and he limits the gophers in a humane and non-toxic way. But it does take time, and let's talk about that difference between the time we want to do things and the time it takes. Right back.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, folks, they are coming to get your crop, whatever that crop might be. Maybe it's an apple tree. Maybe it's your rose bushes. Maybe it's your 1,000 acres of corn. Who knows? But whatever you try to grow, there's going to be something that tries to steal it away from you. They're the pests, and we must control them, or they will control us. Talking with Thomas Whitman of Gophers Limited, and we're talking about how he is bringing a different kind of pest control to the table. Rather than using lots of poisons and whatnot, he is bringing to the table a humane, non-toxic way of managing pests. Thomas, we were talking a little bit off mic here about time. And it seems to me like in agriculture, we have industrialized the process of pest control, making it very easy and time efficient. We simply spray a lot of poisons, or we poison the problem or kill the problem with chemicals and move on. Doesn't take much time, doesn't take much talent, takes a little money, but compared to doing it by hand, it's relatively cheap. And your way seems to be the very expensive way, because it takes a lot of time and it takes a lot of know-how. Am I wrong?
Well, it does take more time to handle pest problems, especially rodent problems like gophers and rats and voles, than it does just to dispense poison in the short run. But in the long run, we're actually eliminating a lot of the predators that are handling part of that problem for us. And it's very tragic, and we found that those predators are almost unanimously, I guess that's a good way to put it, carrying a huge load of poisons in their livers left over from eating poisoned rats and gophers and voles or whatever. And those animals aren't as alert as they used to be, and they're getting run over on our highways. Yeah. And
so, in essence, it looks cheap at the outset to just spread poison around, kill the problem, and move on. But the problem and the poisons don't go away.
Right, but the animals that are helping us, a really good example is a barn owl. A lot of people are attracting barn owls now because they primarily do focus on gophers. And a barn owl family, two adults and two chicks, it's been estimated that they eat about 1,000 gophers a year. That's a lot of gophers. So if you attract barn owls and all you need to do is put a barn owl box up, you're saving yourself a lot of work and labor. But that alone won't solve the problem. There has to be an approach that's multidimensional.
And thus the time and the talents.
Right. You have to actually do some gopher trapping yourself if you want to get the problem solved. Mm-hmm. You know, then people have actually gotten to the point where they're practically gopher free. Just simply by
being diligent and being there and persistent, right?
Well, diligent is the key, and one thing I've found with farmers is that they have such a multitude of tasks and on a farm that it seems like gophers are the last thing they look at until they become such a big problem that they can't control it.
Right.
Gets out of control.
And that kind of explains the rationale behind industrializing agriculture. You know, you try to mitigate these expenses to the best you can. And yet here we are with You know, we're talking about regenerative agriculture. We're talking about an agriculture that is sustainable and organic. And all of those are very expensive in terms of time and know-how. And the other way is cheap at the outset, but not as we go along, because those poisons keep compounding themselves. And we end up with problems not necessarily on the farm, but maybe downstream in the city. So is there any way of measuring those related costs? I mean, I always think that things should cost what they truly do cost. And it seems like by using poisons and whatnot to control pests, it's really cheap at the outset, but expensive as those poisons compound themselves in our bodies. But is there a way of figuring out the true cost of those poisons? Has anybody ever dealt with that?
Well, I'm not sure I've seen any studies that have given any costs of poisons. I mean, how can you put a cost on the death of a mountain lion? But one thing I have done is done a pretty good analysis of the amount of damage that people sustain on a farm every day. I used to work at the Center for Agroecology, also known as the Farm and Garden at UC Santa Cruz, and every day I would go out and catch gophers there. And I started trying to figure out how much damage was happening on a daily basis, and so I started counting the plants that were being killed and making an average. And for example, if a gopher got a tomato plant, that's 25 pounds of tomatoes at $2 a pound at the minimum. So there's $50 right there. And so, you know, a gopher is capable of taking out about 6 or 10 plants a day. So anyway, my average was that we were losing $600 a day in produce to gophers. And the amount of time it would take.
That wasn't a big farm.
No, that was like 5 acres.
5 acres.
The amount of time it would take to manage the gopher population actually isn't that much. It just takes persistence and daily attention. And integrating that attention into normal farm operations, like if you're putting irrigation pipe out every day, you should be moving your gopher traps around. When you integrate those things and do it on a daily basis, you can minimize those animals. And those animals, especially gophers, are territorial animals, and you can't fit that many per acre. Usually in Santa Cruz, this area, we're looking at 20 to 30 gophers per acre. That's not very much. It looks like there's more because they make a new mound or two every day. But farmers have managed to eliminate gophers on the center of their farms. And in some cases, in some vineyard situations, we've installed gopher barriers, a whole new thing I'm working on, where we build a fence that's half underground and half above ground, because gophers do invade from the surface more than underground.
Wow.
And we've managed to block off where vineyards next to a natural area by using this special fence. And the most interesting part about the fence is at some point a gopher will get to the end of the fence and then just try to slip around the side. And so we terminate the fences with a spiral, so that once a gopher gets to the end of the fence, he gets returned back to the fence going the other direction. So he can never get around the fence.
Know your enemy, right? You have to know your enemy so before you can outsmart it. Well, folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson with Thomas Whitman talking about pest control. How it is much less expensive to just use poisons in the short term, much more expensive in the long term. What to do without poisons. That's what we'll ask Thomas when we get back. Do stay tuned.
And now, more of What's Eating What on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, it is a lot less expensive in terms of time and know-how and everything else to just poison the pests. But that's just in the short term. In the long term, much more expensive because of what happens to our environment. A good example of that, Thomas Whitman, you've been working a lot with mountain lions, have been paying particular attention to what's happening with mountain lions, because we go after rats with rodenticides, and the dead rats end up with the predators. And what happens to mountain lions when they eat the dead rats from being poisoned?
Well, mountain lions are the apex predator, and they're the ones people are interested in the most, it seems. I mean, we're also talking about bobcats and coyotes and all kinds of predators, including our raptor predators.
Raptors, yeah.
But mountain lions make the news every time. And when a mountain lion is killed by overdosing on eating poisoned animals like gophers or rats, it's big news. And there's been a very interesting and large study by the California Fish and Game lately. There's a scientist named Stella McMillan who does a lot of the investigating to see what killed these animals, and it's been found that the poisons end up in the animals' livers and slow them down, and then they become less successful hunters themselves, and they get mange, and they eventually die from the poison, or they get hit by cars, or become predated, become eaten themselves by other animals.
Always cheap in the front end, always expensive in the long term, it seems like. And so we'll talk a little bit about how we can manage smartly. First of all, it's expensive, so we have to make it as efficient as possible. We have to make pest control as efficient as possible. Got to know your pest. Got to know what their needs are. Got to have to think like them, right? You have to think like a gopher.
Well, I try not to think like a gopher. I give myself more credit than that.
Well,
but
you're
right.
Talking about the fence, and you know that the gopher's got to travel the fence until it finds a way into the garden. So you pull a little trick on him and turn him right back into himself, so he goes back down the fence line. But that's, you have to think, you have to know what they're doing, right?
Right. I guess that's another way to put it.
Yeah.
I try to tell people that I train not to overthink a gopher's activity. You know, there are so many superstitions about gophers and your scent and all this thing that keeps gophers from getting caught by traps. But really, it's relatively simple. And so what I've done, because the mission of my company is to give people alternatives to using poisons, is try to find the most efficient and successful trap and technique. And so I've come to this surface trapping technique that when I train a vineyard crew or a farm crew, they have to find the freshest gopher mound, open it up, put the trap in, and be gone to the next one in less than a minute.
Wow.
Now, a lot of the traditional trapping takes 10 to 15 minutes to set a trap set, and so it's very time intensive. But if you can do this very quick trapping and using a trap that's effective, and they just did a study up at UC Davis where they tested several of the different common traps. I don't want to tell you the names of these traps. It's not fair to the manufacturers. But they did find that the trap that I used has an efficacy of over 40%. That means half the traps you set can catch a gopher, where the other traps are in the range of 20-some percent. So finding an effective trap is the most important thing, and finding an effective and speedy way to use that trap.
Which is your knife, your soil knife.
Well, I use this knife called a Hori Hori, which has become a very popular tool, which is a very easy way to open a gopher mound. And getting farm crews to stop using a shovel to open up mounds and start using this simple tool is a huge way to save time. Now, the other part of it is it has to be part of it's not about taking care of your gophers and then thinking about something else. It's about management and daily pressure and keeping your traps in the field and not in your barn.
And what you're saying is it's not a one-time thing. It's an ongoing effort. You have to be there and you have to be persistent.
Right, because the pressure of invasion is constant. And gophers do invade from the surface. So if you have fields around you, you're going to get more gophers. And that's why working the centers out is a huge benefit, whereas you only need to patrol the boundaries.
There you go. Once you get the center figured out, all you have to do is patrol. It's just like war, isn't it?
Well, it's kind of like that.
Seems like it to me.
It is a war, actually.
It is a war. And if you're going to fight a war, you may as well fight to win. And the best way to do that is, first of all, you have to know the enemy, and you have to be able to outthink that enemy and work efficiently.
Right, and you have to understand especially the difference between an animal that is a problem and an animal that's not a problem.
Hold that thought right back. Do stay tuned. Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, Thomas Whitman, and you.
So much to say, so little time to say it on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, Thomas Whitman, we have a few minutes left. So much to talk about. Pests, how do we manage them, control them, and doing so in such a way that we do not harm ourselves nor our environment. Much easier to do with poisons. You don't have to think much, don't have to take a lot of time, don't have to start from the center and work your way out, don't have to build fences. You just poison everything and there you are. But that poison just does not go away. It stays in the environment in some form or another. And it seems to me like that's one of the consequences that we're going to have to face up to, is the fact this stuff does bioaccumulate, and it does bioaccumulate in other critters and in ourselves. So if we're really clever, we're going to have to come to grips with this, and sooner or later, maybe we're just going to have to do it the old-fashioned way.
The old-fashioned way. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is tricky. You know, there's another animal we haven't talked about yet, which is very rampant here in California, and that's the California ground squirrel.
Oh, boy.
It's probably the most poisoned animal in California. And as an animal that gets poisoned by an anticoagulant especially, it makes the animal extremely thirsty, so they tend to come to the surface, and then they get eaten by other animals. And
there it is in the food chain, just like that.
Yeah. So they're hard to deal with, and they're, unlike gophers, they're an animal that's a community. They even have assigned duties for people in the, not people, but other other ground squirrels. Like, one's always sitting on a fence post watching for danger. And populations can expand rapidly,
So what do you do about them if you don't poison them? How do you manage pests without poison?
Well, in ground squirrels, we've had a lot of success with this trap that's called a, there is a couple of manufacturers. The one I like the most is called the Black Fox Repeating Ground Squirrel Trap. Because ground squirrels are a community animal, they tend to do things together. And this trap can catch a large part of a colony at one time.
Wow.
But you have to fool them into going into this trap. And the way you do it is by pre-baiting day after day. And like after seven or more days, if they're coming to this little bait pile, that you have a trap which is locked so they can't get in it next to it. Mm-hmm. They get used to the trap and very used to getting the bait every day, and then
kind of like they catch bears.
Yeah, and then after 7 days, you put the trap there with the bait in it. It's kind of like bait and switch. And once one ground squirrel gets into that trap, the rest of the colony wants to go in too.
Wow.
So you end up catching a large, well, I've seen as many as 20 caught in one trap in one day.
Well, Thomas, how do people find out about your work?
Well, gophersunlimited.com is my website, and there's lots of information there about what I do and why I do it. And I also have a YouTube channel. You could just go to YouTube on Gophers Limited, which has lots of videos about gopher trapping in effective ways.
And then you can be a pest control expert yourself. Catch those gophers. Go to bed with a big smile on your lips because you're in control. Folks, this has been The Food Chain. Michael Olson with Thomas Whitman and you. Thanks for tuning in.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.